Bill Ferris devoted his career to collecting and preserving the stories of the South. He is recently retired professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and works closely with the Center for the Study of the American South. After 60 years of collecting stories, he was approached to create a box set of his work, teamed up with a record label, Dust to Digital, created Voices of Mississippi, Artists and Musicians Documented by William Ferris. And then...
And the Grammy goes to... William Ferris, Michael Graves, April Ledbetter, and Steve Lance Ledbetter.
There it is, fresh from his trip to Los Angeles, the Grammy Award-winning Bill Ferris joins us in the studio today. Bill, congratulations. Welcome back.
Thanks. It's wonderful to be with you.
What was it like for you? I mean, we're going to talk more about this work, but I have to know what it was like after these decades of collecting these stories, stories of voices that people didn't want to hear and then ultimately did hear and found, I think, very gratifying, as we'll hear when we hear how well the box set is doing. But what was it like to be recognized like that?
Well, Frank, it was almost like a dream, because the Grammys, for people who work with music, are like the Nobel Prize for writers. And all of my heroes, like Quincy Jones, T-Bone Burnett, they are frequent members and recipients of those awards. And for someone who's worked with the kinds of artists I've worked with in prisons and little juke joints, it's beyond the imagination that that music would ever be elevated in the way that the Grammy does.
Yeah, I mean, fascinating. It's precisely that. These are people you've been recording who were not likely ever to win a Grammy, not for lack of talent, but just because of their circumstances. So there you are. Tell us more about this box set and how it came about.
Well, about 10 years ago, a very gifted couple, Lance and April Ledbetter, who run Dust to Digital, a company in Atlanta that produces beautiful new box sets. They're elegant, Grammy-winning productions on music, much of which is Southern, and I had used many of their projects in my classes. And they came to Chapel Hill, and we met, and they said, we'd like to go through your archive and create a box set. And I said, by all means. And that began a long journey of some variety of teams that went through it. I think none of us knew how much was there and how much time it would take, but they came up with what I view as the crown jewels of my work as a folklorist in this box set.
Of course, a lot of your work has been archived in other places. How much of it was sitting home in shoeboxes?
Well, now it's all in the Southern Folklife Collection at the University of North Carolina, and it's all streamed in a digital format, so every recording I ever made can be downloaded and listened to online, which I find amazing.
Then the question is, going through it all to select those cuts for this particular, what was that process like?
Well, there were several teams that over time worked with individual artists and selected what they thought was the representative sound. Scott Beretta stayed for the full duration, and he worked through the music, the stories, both blues and gospel music, and put together a beautifully balanced body of sound recordings, along with my documentary films and a book that transcribes the voices of music and storytellers, which for me is especially important because I teach courses on Southern literature and the oral tradition, and I view this box set as oral literature. And so to be able to read the narration as well as hear it and the music is especially important.
Well, let's go out on the music of Sam Myers. We're going to come back and continue this conversation with Bill Ferris, who won a Grammy for Voices of Mississippi. I'm going to talk about Sam Myers. We'll get your take on just who he was, but why don't we listen to some of his music? We'll take a break, and then we'll come back to the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here's Sam Myers.
You talking about your woman. I wish the good Lord you could see mine. Talking about your woman. I wish the good Lord you could see mine. Every time the little girl starts loving, she brings our sight to the blind. Her daddy must have been a millionaire, 'cause I can tell by the way she walked. Must have been a millionaire.
This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Longtime folklorist Bill Ferris took home a Grammy for a collection of his work called Voices of Mississippi, Artists and Musicians, documented by William Ferris. Took 10 years to compile the work. It was 60 years in the making, and it paid off. Voices of Mississippi won Grammys for Best Historical Album and Best Album Notes for the 120-page booklet that accompanied the box set. Bill Ferris is with me now. We just played the music of a couple of minutes ago, Sam Myers. Tell us more about Sam.
Sam Myers was an amazing blues artist who was blind. And when we hear him singing a blues of Sonny Boy Williamson, I love to make love to my baby. She brings eyesight to the blind. It's especially powerful because for him as a blind man, that had a double level of impact.
You grew up in Mississippi. What got you interested in this kind of work?
Well, I grew up on a farm outside of Vicksburg, Mississippi, and as a child, 4 or 5 years old, a lady named Mary Gordon would take me to the little church on the farm. We were the only white family in that community, and all the other families were black. And every first Sunday, they gathered to worship, and I would join them. And I learned the hymns, and over time, I realized there were no hymnals in the church. They were all sung from memory. And when those families were no longer there, the music would disappear. So I began to record and photograph and later film those services. And that led me to start doing the same recordings of blues singers in the area and eventually to study folklore as a field and basically devote my life to preservation of the kinds of sounds that I heard as a young child.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting to think about developing an ear for it first and then going out and asking sort of academically what's going on here, yeah. Right? What was that like for you to sort of put those two worlds together?
Well, I've always, when I was studying English, felt frustrated that I couldn't study the ballad, the blues, the stories that I was recording. And simply by accident, one morning over breakfast, I was a student in Ireland, and in a bed and breakfast, I had the pleasure of meeting Francis Utley, who was doing research on Irish folklore. And I complained to him, he was chairman of English at Ohio State, that English departments wouldn't allow me to study the oral literature. And he smiled and he said, "You should be in the folklore field." And I said, "What is that?" And he explained, and I applied and was accepted at the University of Pennsylvania. And when I met my advisor, Kenneth Goldstein, I brought a box of my tapes and photographs in and put them on his desk. And I said, "Dr. Goldstein, is this the kind of thing I can do here?" He smiled and he said, "That, my boy, will be your dissertation."
And was it?
It was.
You worked with so many people and developed an ear for so many kinds of music, and in many ways it brings to our ears and our attention underrepresented voices, people who we otherwise would not have heard. A lot of your work, or some of your work anyway, revolves around prison life, and Voices of Mississippi has a clip from the inmates at Mississippi's notorious Parchman Prison. Tell us more about that recording.
Well, I had heard the Lomax recordings done several decades earlier in Parchman Penitentiary, powerful work chants, and I wanted to know if they were still being sung. So I went to Parchman Penitentiary, to the Lambert, Mississippi satellite where the Lomaxes had recorded and met the prison warden who had been there, Sergeant Webb. And in fact, the inmates were still singing those work chants, and they're incredibly powerful songs that accompany the chopping of wood and the hoeing of cotton. All the manual labor was accompanied in that community by song.
Let's hear a clip from your album.
Did you hear about the water boy drowned? Did you hear about the water boy drowned? The Mobile Bay, Lord, the Mobile Bay, there's a deep in 40 feet of water.
That's a clip from the Grammy-winning box set Voices of Mississippi by Bill Ferris, inmates at Parchman Farm singing Waterboy Drowned at the Mobile Bay. We talk about not only the way those songs, but we say Parchman Farm is infamous because it was really ground zero for the industrial prison system developed in the South and now a nationwide phenomenon that is part and parcel of this political economy to keep it going. It certainly was in the South. Talk about the role those songs played.
Well, those songs were a way of survival and often would communicate not only warnings if the boss was coming, but they could actually say things to the boss's face that would be dangerous if they were in conversation, but the boss would laugh because it was in music. And music was a kind of safe space where you could say and do things without fear of being injured or even killed for saying them.
You also have a recording from Walter Lee Hood in the Parchman Inmates. Tell us, that sounds a little more refined. Tell us more about that particular group.
Well, Walter Lee Hood had this incredible falsetto voice, and he was, because of its high-pitched tone, he would lead a lot of the work chants, and his voice would soar above the sound of axes working, chopping wood. And he also led a gospel group in a church service inside the prison that I recorded with a quartet that he was the head of.
Let's listen.
It's nobody's fault story, surely, and about a man, Jill, on the bone, on high, and a hurt man cry, and a coming from a side, and a chappy for a help, and a home on high. The Jesus is born, and he sure must die, but oh, Lord, gonna tell you about a rhythm and died, and by his friend Peter, here one there night, but oh,
Walter Lee Hood and the Parchman Inmates and the Home on High, featured in Voices of Mississippi, a Grammy Award-winning collection by folklorist Bill Ferris. Talk about that style of music, too, and kind of where that would be used. It's a form of gospel, right?
Yes. It's also a form of call and response, just like the work chant. You have a caller and the work team responds. In this gospel, you have the lead voice of Walter Lee Hood and the quartet responding, and there's an intimate powerful synchronicity to the music. And it's heard in every area of black music. With B.B. King, his voice will sing, and then Lucille, the guitar, will respond. So you are listening to a very ancient relationship of music with roots in Africa that is part of the Parchment tradition, but it's also part of contemporary music in the black church, the preacher, and the congregation.
And in many ways, popular music today
really
has that. And what's striking about it is that it's such close repetition that never gets monotonous.
That's true.
I listened to that over and over again to figure out what was happening to me, why I was riveted every single time I listened, and I couldn't stop listening, even though the pulse is probably 7 seconds long and it repeats for 2.5 minutes. But never repeats.
It's hypnotic, mm-hmm. And there's a quality to that music and to much of the music that puts you in a trance as you listen.
Amazing. What's it like, though, to be in the prison and understand also the political implications? Because in many ways, you've said before that you got into this for political reasons, right?
Yes. For me, recording these voices in the 60s was a political act. They were voices that were unheard on every form of media, and they were telling stories that they asked, if I did the recording, would I promise to tell the story when I wrote the book or made the record? And I said, I will. So it's creating a legacy for invisible voices that will never be invisible again.
What about the women in this? There are a number of women and female groups that are featured. What was their role, and how were they featured and understood at the time you were recording back in the 60s and 70s?
Well, women were clearly an important part of the blues and the gospel. Within the church, they're a very vocal part of gospel music. And within the blues as well, I recorded sessions where Maudie Shirley would respond to Pinetop Johnson's blues piano in a call and response. And the women were just as strong and eloquent in their voices as were the men.
Tell me about Fannie Bell Chapman and family.
Fannie Bell Chapman was really unique. She was a faith healer, gospel singer, composer, who would go into hospital rooms and homes and heal people. She had special powers, and her music was a part of that healing ceremony. She called it a healing band because they would travel and sing wherever people needed them. And her music really was quite powerful.
Who was in the band?
Her family. Her daughters were the primary vocalists and their husbands.
Let's listen to a little clip of Fannie Bell Chapman and family.
We hope everyone enjoyed that beautiful number coming from our mother in our own arrangements. And now we come to you with a beautiful number. Here's my rock, my swing.
Grammy Award-winning Voices of Mississippi, Fannie Bell Chapman and family. That's a record. We're going to wait, and I can hear a wait till the midnight hour kind of starting out in that tune, right?
That's right.
Pretty fascinating stuff. She playing the guitar? Who's playing the guitar?
Her daughter played the guitar, and others were playing the tambourines And again, call and response, very powerful, engaged sounds of gospel music.
And that sounded like a performance. There was an audience there. Did they go around and tour as well?
They toured, not very widely. They mostly performed within their community in southern Mississippi.
You've got some spoken word on this, conversations, stories. Not everybody is an unknown performer and unseen. You talked to Alex Haley on this, and also B.B. King. You've got some tape with him. And I think we need to play this right away because this is fascinating. And I guess maybe everybody knows this story, but I didn't. This is B.B. King explaining how Lucille got her name.
I was playing a place called Twist, Arkansas. In the wintertime, we had a big container. It looked like a big garbage pail, and they would sit it in the middle of the floor. And they would fill it about half full with kerosene. Down home, we call it coal oil. And they would light this fuel. There wasn't no fuel prices either. This is all they had for heat. But this particular night, two guys started to fight. And one of them knocked the other one over on this container of kerosene. And when he did, it spilled on the floor. And everybody started to try and put it out, and it seemed to burn more. And everybody started making it for the front door when they figured they couldn't put it out, including B.B. King. But when I got on the outside, I remembered that I'd left my guitar on the inside, ran off and left it. And I went back for it, but the guy is telling me, asking me not to do it. And then the building started to collapse around me. I almost lost my life trying to save my guitar. So the next day we found that two men had gotten trapped in rooms above the dance hall and had burned to death. We also found that these two men that was fighting about a lady. And we learned the lady's name was Lucille. I never could meet her. But I named my guitar Lucille to remind me never to do a silly thing like that again.
B.B. King, from the Grammy Award-winning Voices of Mississippi box set by folklorist Bill Ferris. Where was that recorded?
That was recorded at Yale University when B.B. came to speak with my students.
Very cool. Well, also, conversation that you were involved in with James Thomas, also known as Son Ford. Tell us a little bit about him. I want to play a clip here in a second about a conversation you had concerning whether or not there would ever be a black president. But tell us who Son Ford was.
Son Ford was one of the first bluesmen that I worked with in Leland, Mississippi. And I was wandering around looking for blues artists, and I asked someone in Leland if there were any there, and they said, "Well, there's Son Thomas over in Black Dog," and that was the black neighborhood. So I went to his home, knocked on the door, and his wife came, and she said, "What do you want?" I said, "I'm looking for James Thomas." She said, "He doesn't live here." So I turned around to leave, and she said, "What do you want with him?" And I said, "I want to put him in a book I'm writing on the blues." She said, "He'll be back in about a half hour. Just sit out there and wait." So that was the meeting in 1967, and a friendship was forged that lasted the next 30 years for the rest of his life. And he was my teacher. He taught me about blues and the black experience, and my students as well. He came to Yale every year I was there. And my friend Tom Rankin, who wrote the essay for these stories, who works with the Center for Documentary Studies, did a beautiful essay in the box set about storytelling and James Thomas in particular.
You have a conversation, we don't have time to play it now, a conversation that took place in a cemetery where you speculate about the possibility of there ever being a black president. James didn't think so. James Thompson did not think so. Thomas did not think so. You did. What year was that?
That was 1974.
Fascinating stuff. Bill Ferris, congratulations.
Thank you, Frank.
Bill Ferris is a folklorist, retired UNC Chapel Hill professor, and recent Grammy Award winner. Decades of his work are compiled in an award-winning album, Voices of Mississippi, Artists and Musicians, documented by William Ferris. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we preview a documentary that looks at the resistance young boys face when they pursue a career in dance. Stay tuned.